Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch Prudential Productivity Awards, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas. Sponsored by Prudential, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans. More information online at floridataxwatch.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida PBA President John Rivera accuses President Barack Obama of demonizing police for public comments he made about the shootings of two black suspects, but Obama's supporters are praising him for not ducking a difficult issue.
So he could not be silent when you have millions of people viewing a video that essentially equates to the murder of a human being in Baton Rouge.
Also this week, a veteran Florida congresswoman now faces a far more daunting challenge than just opposition at the ballot box.
Oh, I am clean. Goodness, clean. Yes.
We'll also get the latest on the state's toxic algae outbreak, a non-decision at the U.S. Supreme Court that will impact children of undocumented immigrants, and visit the place some call the 4th of July gay capital of the South. This is Capitol Report. Following the Thursday night deaths of five police officers in a hail of sniper fire in Dallas, the head of the Florida Police Benevolent Association is accusing President Barack Obama and others of demonizing law enforcement. We get that story from Jim Ash.
Florida PBA President John Rivera wastes no time pointing to comments Obama made the day after the police shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile in Louisiana and Minnesota.
We have a president and some celebrity, like Beyonce, who demonize police officers in cases that they know nothing about. And they're quick to make irresponsible statements, which help fuel situations that we're seeing today.
But a review of Obama's statement suggests something different. A day before the Dallas shootings, the president said all Americans should be troubled by the statistics. He said African Americans are 30% more likely than whites to be pulled over and three times more likely than whites to be searched. In the same press conference, the president quoted from letters he gets from police officers who complain about being demonized.
And so to all of law enforcement, I want to be very clear. We know you have a tough job. We mourn those in uniform who are protecting us, who lose their lives.
After Dallas, Obama called the shootings despicable and asked for the nation's prayers.
Even as yesterday I spoke about our need to be concerned as all Americans about racial disparities in our criminal justice system, I also said yesterday that our police have an extraordinarily difficult job, and the vast majority of them do their job in outstanding fashion.
Rivera worries police will be too cowed to use force when it's necessary. He also thinks police are losing the public relations war because they're ordered to withhold comments until all the facts are in. He wishes more elected officials would do the same.
Just let the process work. Let justice do its thing, and at the end of the day, we can all criticize it one way or the other.
But Senator Dwight Bullard, a Miami Democrat and a member of the Florida Black Caucus, says the stakes have grown too high and the court of public opinion too immediate to wait. At a time when record numbers of young black men are being sent to prison, often on evidence taken from a surveillance camera, Bullard says it's hard to ask the same community to withhold judgment on a viral video.
There's always this notion that we don't know the full story yet. And it's like people have become tired of hearing that when circumstances speak differently, you know, when a 12-year-old kid is in a park shooting a BB gun, and within 30 seconds of the arrival on scene, that 12-year-old is dead.
In a sense, Bullard says, Obama had no choice.
So he could not be silent when you have millions of people viewing a video that essentially equates to the murder of a human being in Baton Rouge, and then the circumstances in Minnesota where you have the gentleman literally bleeding out.
Bullard and Rivera agree on the need for more thoughtful public discussion. But Bullard says he's also working with local prosecutors, police, and community activists on a Q&A video. He describes it as a kind of do-it-yourself guide to handling police misconduct.
Like, listen, if I have videotape, if I have evidence, if I have a number of eyewitnesses that say that this circumstance has been happening, what are my steps in the process?
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Longtime Florida Congresswoman Corinne Brown is facing federal conspiracy and fraud charges. Lynn Hatter has that story.
To whom God has given much, much is given. And so he's been good to me, and I guess he wants me to go through the burning fire. But I know Sunday morning.
That was Congresswoman Corinne Brown in March fighting changes made to the district she represents. District 5 has been reconfigured from its winding north-south orientation to run east to west from Tallahassee to Jacksonville.
And I've been fighting this fight. And I do think it's an organized effort to take me out now. Now, I do believe that.
Amen.
Now she's in another fight. In addition to a congressional ethics probe currently on hold, she's now facing more than 20 federal corruption charges, both related to her involvement in a charity scheme. At that same press conference, Brown defended herself.
Are you confident that when this is
resolved, yeah, I do. I do.
You'll come out clean?
Oh, I am clean. Goodness, clean. Yes.
The federal indictment against Brown was released Friday. She and her chief of staff, Elias Simmons, are charged with conspiracy to commit mail and wire fraud, multiple counts of mail and wire fraud, concealing material facts on required financial disclosure forms, theft of government property, and filing false tax returns, among other things. Brown, Simmons, and One Door Charity President Carla Wiley are accused of using more than $800,000 raised for college scholarships as their personal slush fund. Only $1,200 was ever handed out in the form of a scholarship. Wiley pleaded guilty to charges in March. Brown is facing a re-election challenge from former state senator Al Lawson. In a statement, he calls Brown's case unfortunate, but promises to, quote, carry the torch of equality, decency, and honesty to Congress.
Well, I think the obvious monkey wrench that could change everything is if Corinne Brown actually gets indicted prior to the election.
That's University of North Florida political scientist Michael Binder speaking in late June. He says the indictment may not hurt Brown's standing with her base, but it could hurt her outside of Duval in the rural areas between Tallahassee and Jacksonville.
It's hard to say how much. Her supporters are pretty loyal, but you would imagine that in the Democrats that are not in Duval, that aren't connected to her, that would hurt her tremendously.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Brown has a very strong base of support, and that was on display Friday as she made her first appearance in a federal courtroom in Jacksonville.
You know, she's done some solid things for this city, and she'll continue to do solid things for this city.
Patrick Macon came out to the courthouse to support the congresswoman.
I think it's just a little mudslinging, you know what I'm saying, but who knows? Nobody knows, you know, but she's going to be tried. You know, we out here to stand for her justice, that she get a fair trial, you know, and not just, you know, mudslinging.
Brown has a narrow 3-point lead over Lawson in the latest survey, with some 40% of people polled undecided on the race. Brown has pleaded not guilty to the charges, and her supporters say they'll stay with her all the way. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the algae bloom scourge grows along Florida's Treasure Coast.
It has been linked to ALS disease and also to Alzheimer's and early onset dementia.
A deadlocked U.S. Supreme Court means no immediate reprieve for children of undocumented immigrants.
We would have had a lot more educated people as a result of the program had it gone into effect, living and working every day legally in the U.S., and now we don't have that.
And Memorial Day may be a bigger event for the LGBT community now, but back in the 60s, the party was on the 4th of July.
50 people were invited the first year, 100 people showed up. The next year it was 600. By 1970, it was over 1,000.
A massive toxic algae bloom that can be seen from space is fouling South Florida beaches. From member station WLRN in Miami, Christine DiMatte talks with Ed Killer, a columnist who covers water issues for the TC Palm Treasure Coast newspapers.
The South Florida summer scorcher days are here. Now, how would you like to pack up the cooler and head to your favorite beach, only to find the ocean water covered with foul-smelling, guacamole-thick, fluorescent green gunk? Well, that's what many Treasure Coast year-round residents and tourists are dealing with. The blue-green algae spread is so bad that Governor Rick Scott last week declared a state of emergency in four Florida counties, including Palm Beach County. Maybe now would be a good time to talk to someone who's out there every day seeing this thing firsthand. Joining us is Ed Killer, a columnist who covers water issues for TC Palm Treasure Coast newspapers. Ed, it's great to have you on.
Glad to be here.
If you looked at this blue-green algae under a microscope, what exactly is it?
Well, it's a bacteria, actually. They're single-celled organisms. If you can imagine just, one tiny organism that's barely visible to the naked eye when it's in the waterway. But what happens is they gather and they concentrate into these giant numbers and multiply and continue to bloom and bloom. We say bloom, it's like a plant, there's photosynthesis there, but it gathers and it can actually cover an entire waterway.
So, Ed, how did this bacteria spread to Florida beaches?
Well, it began really in Lake Okeechobee is where we first saw it. In early May, starting to gather probably about 30 miles long from north to south. By that time, in January, the Army Corps of Engineers had already started a plan to discharge water from Lake Okeechobee in a way to keep the water level of Lake Okeechobee at a manageable depth so that it didn't compromise the Herbert Hoover Dike that surrounds the lake. So from January, they started dumping the water. Well, by May, when the algae bloom began, it was just swept in the current down the St. Lucie Canal and into the South Fork of the St. Lucie River, which is a natural Florida river here in Stuart. And it just washed right into what is normally a brackish estuary. But with all the fresh water being dumped out of Lake Okeechobee, well, that fresh water allows the algae to thrive and grow and continue to live.
Which counties are affected, Ed?
Predominantly, it's Martin County. Lee County hasn't seen this algae yet, but they are part of the governor's state of emergency. In Palm Beach County, they recently identified some there last week that was actually carried down the C-51 canal, which is a narrow canal that goes into Lake Worth Lagoon. It has nothing to do with the bloom that was in Lake Okeechobee. This is the same algae, but it was actually, it just bloomed on its own. And to a lesser degree, the southern part of St. Lucie County, which is, adjacent to the northern border of Martin County, there's been some of the bloom has been indicated there.
Now, the algae, wherever it is shaping up to be more than just a smelly nuisance. What health risks does the algae pose?
Well, the World Health Organization identified this type of algae. It's, like I said, it's a cyanobacteria. It has been linked to ALS disease and also to Alzheimer's and early onset dementia, and also ingesting it can really do some damage to the liver and some other organs. That's why all your public health agencies are issuing avoid contact with the water warnings wherever they can.
And Ed, what is being done now to solve the problem? Who's working on it?
If you ask everybody at every level of government is going to say they're working on it. Nobody's doing anything to stop the algae from coming into the St. Lucie River. It still pours daily at a rate of about 750 million gallons per day. The Army Corps of Engineers scaled back their discharge volume by about 25%, but it really needs to be cut down to zero to give this estuary a chance to use its own tidal flow and salinity to help kill off the algae to a degree where it can actually start to, heal again. And that's not going to happen anytime soon.
We've been chatting with Ed Killer, a columnist who covers water issues for TC Palm Treasure Coast newspapers. I'm Christine DiMatte.
A recent ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court means 4 million undocumented immigrants nationwide will not receive federal protections from deportation. Kate Payne looks into what the ruling means for Floridians.
In 2014, President Obama issued two executive orders offering work permits and relief from deportation to certain undocumented immigrants. The programs are commonly called DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, and DACA Plus, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. DACA Plus expanded a pre-existing program established in 2012. The Supreme Court's recent 4-4 ruling means 100,000 Floridians will not get those protections.
For me, it's personal, right? I have DACA. So it's a little something. It's something temporary, but my parents have nothing.
Catalina Santiago is a student activist in Homestead, and now her family is one of millions nationwide stuck in limbo. After President Obama issued the executive actions, Texas led 22 other states, including Florida, in challenging the programs, saying the administration overstepped its bounds. A Texas judge sided with the states and blocked DAPA and DACA Plus from going into effect. The Supreme Court's lack of decision means the Texas ruling stands.
It was very disappointing, and it means that Florida is going to miss out to the tune of about $100 million in tax revenues just in the next 5 years.
Elizabeth Ritchie is a Tallahassee immigration lawyer and was in the Supreme Court chambers when the ruling came down. According to the Migration Policy Institute, an estimated 100,000 Floridians could have participated in the programs. Ritchie believes immigrants and their families wouldn't be the only ones to benefit.
They're by way of taxes. They're keeping families together. We're missing out on innovations, and we would have had a lot more educated people as a result of the program had it gone into effect, living and working every day legally in the U.S., and now we don't have that.
Research conducted by the immigrant advocacy group United We Dream shows the original DACA recipients were able to build better lives. With the federal protections, people could get higher-paying jobs, go back to school, and help provide for their families. The ruling means Catalina Santiago's parents won't get the same benefits she did.
So it's them having to work long hours under the sun with mediocre pay and having to not have that dignity and respect that they deserve.
But Memphis immigration lawyer Greg Siskind says there is a small glimmer of hope for would-be recipients. Because they don't have serious criminal records, they aren't a top priority for deportation.
Most of those people will probably, they'll be in a limbo state, but they're probably not going to be in any immediate danger of being deported.
But the debate is far from over. Because of the Supreme Court's deadlock, there is a possibility of future legal challenges. Some pundits say the future of DAPA and DACA rests with the next president. Siskind is betting Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton will take the debate on the campaign trail.
I would find it hard to believe that she's not going to be talking about the case and be talking about comprehensive reform and basically, all these issues. You have 2 million more Latino voters than in the 2012 election.
Clinton pledges to expand Obama's immigration reforms, while Republican contender Donald Trump says he'll undo them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Two unions are gearing up to fight over which will represent state correctional and probation officers during the next legislative session, and Sasha Cordner has that story.
For years, the Florida Police Benevolent Association represented thousands of correctional officers and probation officers. That is until 5 years ago when they voted to be represented by the Teamsters Union.
We lost an election in 2011. Especially over the last couple of years, there's been a very growing chorus of officers coming to us saying, hey, could you try to hold another election? We'd like to come back to the PBA. So we decided this year to give it a shot.
FPBA's Executive Director Matt Puckett says the Teamsters contract expired last month, so the association is in the process of triggering an election. By collecting more than 6,000 signatures, they have enough to file an election petition, which must first be verified. In the meantime, Puckett says his union has been listening to correctional officer complaints. The main one, he says, is the Teamsters, quote, nearly invisible presence in the legislature.
You know, a lot of people don't know who they are. They haven't seen them since 2011. You know, despite maybe some things that they were upset with us years ago, you know, one thing that they agreed on is that we were always there.
But the Teamsters statewide coordinator Les Cantrell disagrees. He says his union spoke to lawmakers on everything from staffing levels to better pay, which Cantrell says they're still working on. While Cantrell admits in the time they took over, correctional officers have only received one raise, he says there were some wins.
From the time of the PBA to us taking over the contract, if a correctional officer worked on a holiday, they get special comp. Well, the way the contract was set up in the past, you had so much time to use it, and then you lost it.
Still, some within Cantrell's own union agree with the PBA about the Teamsters' overall lack of a legislative presence like Kim Schultz. The Miami probation officer is hoping to become the next president of the Teamsters union.
I don't believe that PBA is the answer. I've been a probation officer for over 20 years. I was a PBA member up until I joined the Teamsters. We could do a lot better with the Teamsters.
Joined by other correctional officers, Schultz trekked to Tallahassee quite a few times speaking on legislative issues, but she says she did that on her own as a concerned officer. Among her concerns were pay raises and the prison's understaffing levels. In fact, she recently sent a letter to Senate President Andy Gardner, House Speaker Steve Crisafulli, and Governor Rick Scott, calling for a special session to resolve what she calls the, quote, severe understaffing crisis. Officials, officers, and studies all agree an overstressed and understaffed prison workforce has contributed to correctional officers on inmate assaults. And pointing to two prison riots in the panhandle in the past 6 months, Schultz says it's also endangering correctional officers' lives.
And I mean, the secretary testified as to the shortages, and I've spoken about parity of pay and not getting adequate funding or pay, which is why the officers are leaving. My guess is they'll probably be more occurrences as we continue to lose officers and at least the more experienced and qualified officers.
But during a recent visit to Tallahassee, Senate President Gardner says he sees no need for a special session.
Sadly, I think you're seeing a lot of politics being played when it comes to demanding special sessions. Most people realize that the legislature will come back and they'll address that issue if they need to address that.
Meanwhile, both the Teamsters and the Florida Police Benevolent Association say they're both confident they'll win as the union to represent correctional and probation officers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, this 4th of July, visitors descended on Pensacola's beaches for fireworks. Independence Day is a great excuse for a party on the beach. It was no different back in the 60s, and as Nick Evans reports, the celebration became an important event for many gay men and women in the South.
All right, so here we are. It's downtown Pensacola. It's nearly the end of Palafox.
This is Jay Watkins, a historian from Georgia State University, and we're standing in front of a bar called Trader John's, or better, what used to be Trader John's.
This, I believe, is where the original door was. The outside part of it was covered with wood paneling. It was much darker. These windows...
Now it's taken up by a fancy event space and a restaurant, but there's a historical marker out front describing the building's past. Shoe repair, ship chandlery, and starting in the 50s, popular Navy bar. It's actually the basis for TJ's in An Officer and a Gentleman.
What are you doing here?
Well, I thought it was time for me to see legendary TJ's once before I left here.
But Watkins explains Trader John's was important for more than just sailors on leave and a young Richard Gere. He says the owner's live and let live attitude meant it was one of the only places gay men and women could feel comfortable in public.
So if you're gay man or lesbian, there are no gay bars. And so a space where you can be semi-yourself is pretty important when there's nothing else.
And that's about where the Hilliers and Emma Jones come in. Ray and Henry Hillier were a couple in Pensacola who wanted to get and share copies of gay magazines. But at a talk he gave in Pensacola, Watkins explains postal inspectors would sometimes intercept those publications.
They knew that it would be rather difficult to order these kinds of magazines. And so they hit upon an idea.
A female friend of theirs, they enlisted her help in renting a post office box under the name Emma Jones.
And at the time, putting it under a woman's name was enough to avoid most suspicion. In honor of their straw woman, the group called itself the Emma Jones Society, and it met every month at the Hilliers' home to flip through the magazines. And it wasn't long before the Hilliers hit upon an even bigger idea.
And so around a table just inside to the left of the door, so the table that would have been right there, that was the table. And to hear people tell, that's probably where the Emma Jones beach parties were conceived.
Starting in 1965, the Hilliers hosted Emma Jones parties every 4th of July on Pensacola Beach.
50 people were invited the first year, 100 people showed up. The next year it was 600. You know, by 1970, it was over 1,000. By 72, it was over 2,000. By 73, it was growing year after year after year.
And Watkins says their choice of date was intentional, a political act, claiming their place in both the community and the country. And for the most part, things were going fine.
Until 1974, when the disc jockey says that the city is getting a reputation as the gay capital, or as a gay capital of the South. And that was the thing that was too much, the line over which visibility had crossed. And so that's when the pushback happens. When
the parties did pull in visitors from all over the South, but the idea of Pensacola as a gay capital was more of an epithet, thrown around by critics rather than a title claimed by the men and women gathering on the beach. After 1974, local law enforcement cracked down on the revelers, and the beach parties largely went away. The pattern played out again in the 1990s, after a similar party started happening on Memorial Day weekend. Again, the gatherings grew year after year, until they became too visible for some locals. This time, Pensacola was termed the Gay Riviera.
Boom. Now, suddenly, there's a pushback, even though thousands of people had been coming every year to Memorial Day, bringing in millions and millions and millions of dollars. It was estimated in 93. There was an extra $25 million just for that one weekend.
And the money is important. Watkins says local officials cracked down on the LGBT community, ramping up arrests in an effort to preserve the city's image as a tourist destination. But in the 90s, some local businesses pushed back, buying rubber stamps and marking bills that passed through their hands as gay money. And the parties haven't disappeared. Now Pensacola draws well over 100,000 visitors for LGBT events throughout Memorial Day weekend. City officials still have concerns, but now it's not with the people. They worry about trash getting left behind on the beach. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FBRCapReport and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch Prudential Productivity Awards, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas. Sponsored by Prudential, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans. More information online at floridataxwatch.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.